This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by the Star Trek Starships Collection from Eagle Moss, the ultimate collection officially authorized by CBS Studios, featuring vessels from 50 years of Star Trek. Each is expertly sculpted, hand-painted, and comes with an authoritative collector's magazine. Start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D for only $4.95 with free shipping. For details and to order, visit st-starships.com/readyroom. And by audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. If you love podcasts, you're going to love audible.com and the ability to read your favorite books, plus those you've been wanting to get to, while on the go or at work. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more details.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 205, Disco Vulcan Zombies. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Mike Morrison. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including details about the new Star Trek series, as revealed by Brian Fuller, and Rihanna's Sledgehammer video for Star Trek Beyond. Then in the feature, we're joined by Dennis Costello and Philip Gilfus to discuss the Enterprise episode, Impulse. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Mike. It's surprising to see you here again, but I guess I should have expected it since your co-host from Made a Trek, Zachary, was on the last show. How's it going?
Going very well. Zachary left his pillow on the cot. I'm a little upset about that, but I'm glad he gave it up, and here I am.
Exactly. We have a little bit of a running joke going here on the Ready Room now that you and Zachary keep alternating as co-hosts. It's just coincidental. For those listening, we have a sign-up sheet for the Ready Room that all the hosts have access to, and it's sort of first come, first served. Come, you see which episode we're going to do, you put your name in, and it just so happens we're in a stretch of Zach and Mike right now, but it's all good.
It's all good.
Well, Mike, we are coming out of rainy season here in Japan, and it is full on hot here right now. It's 33 degrees Celsius, which in Fahrenheit is known as really hot. It's actually about, I think it's about 91, 92 degrees in Fahrenheit. So I am roasting here. I'm recording with the windows open, the fans on. I've got birds chirping outside. I've got wind chimes going off. Luckily, I have hardware in my studio that's supposed to block all that out, and it's been very successful in past years. But if you hear any birds chirping, we're not in an aviary today. It's just really hot in Tokyo.
Well, Chris, I can relate. I live in Dallas, Texas, and it's pretty hot here as well. And as we're recording this, it is dawning on the 4th of July, the Independence holiday.
That's
and
right.
So outside my window, you can probably hear fireworks. It is, after all, Texas.
You know, that reminds me, Mike. Actually, I forgot that it's 4th of July weekend there in the States and what goes on at that time. And it reminds me that over the course of Trek FM and The Ready Room here being our oldest podcast, this will be the 4th of July that I've been recording this show. And yes, you're right. We deal with this every year. It's nighttime there. People are shooting fireworks outside your windows.
Indeed.
Yes. Well, happy 4th of July to everyone in the U.S. who is listening today. All right. Well, let's jump into some news here. We have two things we're going to talk about. And then in the future, we're going to be joined by Philip Gilfus and Dennis Costello to talk about the Enterprise episode Impulse. So stick around for that. Even if you're not an Enterprise fan, stick around. Listen to what we have to say about space zombies. It makes me wonder, Mike, do you think that we will see any space zombies on the new Star Trek series that's kicking off in January?
I think it would be interesting for sure. Who knows what Fuller's going to do? He's been a little tight-lipped, keeping things a little close to the chest, but only time will tell.
Well, there's been a lot of speculation on what the series is going to be like. We've talked about it some here on the Ready Room. Actually, Larry Nemechek and I speculated on a lot of things a few episodes back. And there have been questions like, how many episodes are going to be in a season? Will they all be released at one time, or will we get them week by week? Will each season tell a different story? Will it be an anthology series? That's one you've been hearing quite a bit as well. And of course, many people have asked, will we have an LGBT character on the show? Which of course would make sense in 2016, 2017 when the show comes out. And Fuller revealed some of that information when he talked to Collider at the Saturn Awards on June 22nd. So now we know a bit more about the series, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that today. So the first thing he was asked about, how much have you written? How long are the seasons going to be? He says that they've got the arc of the first season entirely written and arced out, and they've also entirely broken the first six episodes. And then he goes on to say that they're going to have 13 episodes in a season. So what do you think about this?
I'm not really surprised. And first of all, just to have these first little tidbits of information, it's fan candy for sure. This is kind of the appetizer. I believe we're going to have to wait until we really get into con season to get any real meat and potatoes, as it were, regarding the information about the upcoming series. So I'm really enjoying these little tidbits, and I'm not really surprised that it's going to be 13 episodes. And I think most of us who are very familiar with streaming services, we were expecting something probably more along the lines of 12 or 13 episodes. So that's really just confirmation, I think, more or less of what we've all known. And of course, we also know that he had ideas right out of the box, and bringing in the people that he has brought in to his creative team, I think we all know that they were working just, you know, boots to the ground and were running with it. So it's nice to know that they do have a direction here for this first season.
Yeah, he mentioned that he went in and he asked the CBS people, do you have a plan for what you want to do? And they said, no, we don't really have a plan. And he said, I have a plan. And then they let him run with it. And I think that's wonderful. But the fact that he came in knowing this is what I want to do with Star Trek is great, because there has been this feeling that CBS announced the series because it was the 50th anniversary year, and there was a feeling like we have to do something with Star Trek. I think even apart from CBS All Access, obviously they're trying to get All Access moving forward because that's the future of television. What property do they have that they could better leverage? Well, Star Trek is it, right? That's their golden egg. But I also think that they just felt like it's the 50th anniversary. We've got to make this big announcement. We're not quite ready yet. We don't know what we're doing, but we're going to announce there's going to be a new series, and then we're going to figure it out. That's my feeling. I haven't been told that, but that's my feeling. And I think that when Brian Fuller says that he asked them and they said, we don't have a plan, and then he said, I have a plan, mm-hmm. I think it supports that theory.
Well, being a Star Trek fan, and we've talked about this quite a bit as we've gotten the initial announcements, and then when they said they were bringing Brian Fuller in, we've been talking about this. Brian is a fan. He's written for Voyager. So he not only brings his own fandom into this, but he brings his experience. And I suspect that he's probably wanted to do this for quite a while. I think in his mind, he's always had a direction. I think he's the kind of thoughtful person that has always wondered what if, and now all of a sudden he gets handed the golden ticket and the keys to the kingdom, and he knows exactly where he wants to go. And that's exciting, because we do have a fan who has a plan that knows where he's going.
Yeah. Another thing he said that was interesting, but not surprising, he was asked about how long will each episode be? You know, will they be an hour? Will they be 42 minutes, which is what we got down to by the end of Enterprise? Mm-hmm. And he said, I think our runtime is flexible because it's streaming. Mm-hmm. But they gave us parameters, sort of no more than this, no less than that. So I'm pretty sure that for the first time ever, we're going to get Star Trek episodes that actually vary in length. Within a series, we might get an episode that's 50 minutes. We might get an episode that's 63 minutes. What do you think about that?
Well, 50 minutes, I think, was about the runtime of most of the original series episodes.
Yeah, it was like 52, I think.
Yeah, 52. Yeah. I think that's right. So, again, not unexpected because of the nature of streaming. When you look at some of the series that are popular, for instance, on Netflix, Daredevil and others, Orange is the New Black. If you look at those, at the runtime on those episodes, they're somewhat flexible. And they do run somewhere usually in that 50-minute range, but one might be 51 minutes, another one might be 59. So again, no surprises here.
Yeah, I think it's good. If you're going to tell a story, tell the story, right? Don't cut stuff out just mm-hmm. to hit an arbitrary time. In traditional television, you have to hit that time because you have X number of minutes that you have to fill with commercials. It's amazing to me when I look at the timestamps of Deep Space Nine, for example, and how they nail it within 2 seconds.
Yes.
Week after week after week, you might get 3 episodes in a row that are all 44 minutes and 17 seconds. Like, how do you do that? And you think about what they, I mean, I have an idea how you do that as an editor, but you think about what they cut out in order to hit that, and could that have had value to the story? And so this is another reason why I like the idea that this show is going to be on streaming, because it gives you that flexibility. You tell the number of stories you want to tell. You use the amount of time that you need to use to tell that story. Do you think that Impulse, which we're going to talk about today, do you think it would have been 23 minutes if it were on?
Well, without the B plot, absolutely, it would have been 23 minutes. And, you know, the flip side is true as well. And I think we'll probably mention this when we talk about Impulse. You know, adding content in order to meet that time requirement. I don't think you have to do that when you're doing a show for a streaming service. You write a good story and it is what it is at the end. And whatever time you come in, that's what it is. No last minute writing in order to get it to, you know, this or that or the other thing. Yeah. You just tell your story and let it stand.
Okay. To play devil's advocate on that, because of Impulse, something that we'll talk about today, I'm sure. The fact that they had to hit an arbitrary time forced them to go back and add something to the episode that actually made the episode a lot better. So if you know that you can have as much time you want and you write the story and you get to the end and you think it's great, I have everything I want in here, and you shoot mm-hmm. it and you've never been pushed, like, you need to rethink what you're doing here. And that gives you that moment to go back and say, you know, what if we did this? Because as creatives, we have that, you know, we write, we design. And what you do is you distance yourself from it for a little while, and then you come back to it. And sometimes you see things from a new perspective. Mm-hmm. Could that be missing in the situation?
It could be, Chris, but honestly, the times that content was added in order to meet that arbitrary number, and I think you're right, in Impulse, it works, but how many times did something get thrown in there last minute that just didn't seem to fit in anyway? It was a square peg in a round hole. And so with not having a specific, I mean, he said he's got targets, no less than this, no more than that. But in actuality, he's got some flexibility there. So as a creative, I think he's got the flexibility to say, well, if it makes sense, we can go in and add it. We've got that flexibility to be able to do it. On the other hand, if you've got an arbitrary number to hit and you're pressured to write another 5 minutes of content, I think more often than not, it can fall flat.
Yeah, that is true. So another thing he talked about, he was asked by Collider, Star Trek has never filmed certain subject material because it was filmed at a time when showing a gay character or showing certain kinds of characters was frowned upon. What I'm so looking forward to, they said, is to see you guys be so progressive and all-inclusive. Are you looking at it that way? And Fuller said, absolutely. I think the progressive audience that loves Star Trek will be happy that we're continuing that tradition. Also, because we're CBS All Access, we're not subject to network broadcast standards and practices. It will likely affect us more in terms of what we can do graphically, but Star Trek's not necessarily a universe where I want to hear a lot of profanity either. Mm-hmm. So in this case, I think that it makes sense that they would have a gay character on the show because Star Trek has always tried to be in sync with the times and push things forward a little bit. When you look at it through your 2016 lens, you look back at some past Star Trek and you feel like they weren't progressive enough and they avoided this topic and they avoided that topic. But as the people from Collider here said, that society itself has to be open to those topics in order mm-hmm. for you to start tackling them on broadcast television. So I don't think it's fair to accuse Star Trek of not doing this or not doing that at a certain period in the past when you're judging it from the vantage point of today's society, right? So I think that with the new series, they probably will go that route. How do you feel about it?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised a bit to have an LGBT character in the new Star Trek. I mean, you're absolutely right. This is 2016. I think that's the route they're going to go. I think he'll definitely go there. In fact, when you talk about the progressiveness of Star Trek in the past, we can go back to Deep Space Nine and we see that envelope being pushed even then. I mean, we had, for instance, Mirror Universe Kira, who for all intents and purposes was bisexual. We have Dax, who to some degree was gender bending. She was a man, she was a woman. So I think we've seen these things, and certainly here we are all these years removed in 2016. I think that's going to push forward. And quite frankly, why not have an androgynous character or an asexual character and even push that further?
Well, one thing that we've never seen on screen, but you'll know if you read the novels, is that the Andorians have four genders. Mm-hmm. And they have very complex relations. So that's another way that you could branch into the diversity of sexual identity and personal identity in a science fiction setting in a way that fits with science fiction storytelling, fits with Star Trek. My concern is that I just don't want to see a character thrown in just to check off a box on a list. Like, we have to have this character. I want the character to make sense for the storytelling, and I'm confident that Brian Fuller and this fantastic team of writers that he's put together will be able to do that. But I do want to see them do that, because that's what Star Trek has done over the years, is that they have found meaningful and creative ways to approach these subjects and then open people's eyes up to it a bit.
I agree completely, and I follow some of the fan bulletin boards and many of the conversations that happen out on social media. And I know there are a lot of fans who are hopeful that there'll be an LGBT captain in this particular iteration of Star Trek. And I feel as you do, Chris, I don't want a character just for the sake, an LGBT character just for the sake of, as you said, checking the box. So, you know, I hope they don't force it. I hope it's not something that is just there to satisfy whatever executive push there is or fan push there is. If it makes sense for the story, then, you know, I can certainly understand going there. And again, Star Trek has always been progressive, and we can look back and be critical, but if you go to the context of the shows, and when we talk about androgynous characters, TNG did it, Enterprise did it with Cogenitor. So these kind of explorations of complex relationships and procreation and so
identities.
Forth. Identities, yes, absolutely. I think Star Trek has always been progressive in that regard.
Yeah. And I think they'll do it right. And I think those who are most strongly advocating for an LGBT character to be on the series also do not want it to be checking a box.
Mm.
The character's identity should just be, this is who they are, and it shouldn't be a factor. The thing is, don't make that the identity of the character. That's part of who they are. That has nothing to do with how they do their job, the role they play with their crewmates as a Starfleet officer. It shouldn't. That shouldn't define them, right? That's part of their identity. It doesn't define who they are purely. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And I'll exit out of the Star Trek universe for a second and point to one other show that I can think of that did this very well. And that was the show Warehouse 13 had a gay character, and it was who he was. But it wasn't something that was thrown out there just to, again, check a box. It was something that made sense for the character. It was part of who he was. It factored into some of the storytelling. He wasn't ashamed to say that he was a gay man. There were a couple of interesting, awkward scenes in which women were attracted to him, and he told them that he was gay. But it wasn't something that was thrown into an episode in a way that didn't make sense for the unfolding of the episode. So I think Star Trek will do this very well. They've always been very respectful. They've always been very progressive. They've always explored these subjects and topics and situations in ways that were responsible and made for better storytelling.
Exactly. So I think that we will see a character like that, and I think we should see a character like that. If there weren't an LGBT character amongst the crew, then it would stand out, I think, in 2017.
Sure.
When the show airs, as a glaring omission. So it seems that they are headed in that direction. So when will we know for sure about things like this? Fuller also revealed potential timing. He doesn't know exactly when, but he said that he thinks around the time of Comic-Con, so I assume San Diego Comic-Con, they might start revealing some of the specifics. He says that it's interesting because normally I love talking about everything, and I'm sort of relieved I've been muzzled by CBS on it because I do less interviews, so I can spend more time writing. So maybe if it were up to him, we'd know everything that's going on right now. But of course, CBS doesn't want to let the cat out of the bag too soon. He also said they haven't booked any directors yet, which is interesting because I've heard speculation that Alex Kurtzman may direct the pilot himself and then step back from that type of thing to establish the look and feel and the style of the show. And I don't know if that's going to be the case or not. It sounds like they really don't have a plan there yet.
I heard a rumor to that regard as well.
He also says that they've met a few actors. It's an interesting process. They haven't actually cast anyone yet, but he says that they want to carry on what Star Trek does best, which is being progressive, as we just talked about. So it's interesting to look at all of these roles through a colorblind prism and a genderblind prism. So that's exciting. The other last point that we should talk about here as we wrap up this discussion is the issue of the show being an anthology and whether it is set between The Undiscovered Country and The Next Generation, because these have been two of the big rumors out there. And Brian Fuller was talking this time to MoviePhone, and he said, "I've read that we're set before The Next Generation, after The Undiscovered Country," which is false. So no beating around the bush there, Mike.
None at all.
That's not the time period of the show.
None at all. That's pretty decisive.
He also said, "I've read that it's an anthology show." which is not accurate. So it's interesting to see those suggestions and seeing the truth mixed in with them and going like, oh, they got that part right. So some of what we're hearing is true. It's not all false, but it's not an anthology show. It's not set between The Undiscovered Country and The Next Generation. And there aren't going to be 26 episodes. Are you disappointed that it's not an anthology show?
No, actually, I've been very public in saying I hope that they don't do an anthology show. I was afraid that it would limit character development of worlds, story development. I just felt that it would impede that altogether. So I'm glad to hear that it's not an anthology.
That's how I feel too.
Now, the fact that he says it's false that it's going to be set between The Next Generation and Undiscovered Country, or rather vice versa, I think that's pretty decisive on his part to say that's false. But even though he says it's not an anthology show, Chris, I believe he went on to talk about how we'll see lots of crews in the story, and yeah, maybe somewhere down the line we'll come back and revisit these crews. So that sort of sounds a little more like an anthology. So I'm not sure. I mean, he says, no, it's not going to be an anthology, but then he sort of drops some hints there that kind of sounds more like an anthology to me. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
For me, when we talk about an anthology show, we're talking about each season having a very distinct setting.
Sure.
And a distinct time period. Mm-hmm. So we might have a season about Pike and the Enterprise before Kirk was the captain.
Right.
And then we might have a season about how the Klingons first became a spacefaring race. And then we might have a season about the 31st century and what's happening on Earth. Mm-hmm. And that, I think he's very clearly saying, we're not doing that. When we talk about other crews, because he was asked about why is crews plural, and he says, I think we'll see a lot of different crews. They're probably just going to take an approach where we feel the size of the Federation and the vastness of the Star Trek universe a little bit more than we have on previous shows. So instead of following these seven people around all the time as if there's nothing else happening in the Star Trek universe, which is how it often feels on Star Trek, we're going to know that there's a bit more going on. Maybe there are going to be other ships that we see regularly, and they're not the people with their names in the title credits, but we see them often enough that we know, yeah, there's a lot of other stuff going on out here. I think that's maybe what he's talking about.
That's an interesting perspective, and I hadn't thought about that, but we sort of saw that between TNG and Deep Space Nine. We did it just a little bit at the beginning of Voyager, where we had Voyager dock to Deep Space Nine, and they're swapping crew out and getting supplies to go hunt down the Maquis. So we've kind of seen that before. So that would be very interesting to do that on a much larger scale, where the A plot might be taking place on this particular ship, the B plot might be taking place on a space station, and occasionally we bring these storylines together. That might be interesting.
Yeah, it could be, and you could do that. And I think that if you're telling one story over the course of 13 episodes, which is what Brian Fuller has said they're going mm-hmm. to do, you can do that. Because what you really have is you have a story that spans 13 hours.
Yes.
Instead of 42 minutes, 42 minutes, 42 minutes. And so then you can make that work. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. But it's great to get more information about the series. And I'm looking forward to finding out what else we're going to learn when Comic-Con rolls around. He even said that eventually we might see some established canon characters appear on the show.
That would be very interesting indeed.
All right. Well, that was a long discussion about the new TV series, but hey, that's the biggest topic around right now. Other than Star Trek Beyond, which is also a big topic, and I just want to touch briefly on this one story that's been floating around, and it's gotten some people very upset, and then other people say they love it. So as you would expect, in Star Trek fandom, opinions are split. A video came out from Rihanna, a song called Sledgehammer, which will appear on the soundtrack and will be heard in the movie. Some people hate the idea of an established star like Rihanna and a musical style that's not orchestral TV soundtrack music being used in Star Trek. I don't personally understand this myself, why it's such a big issue, but how do you feel about it?
Well, Chris, I'm not a big fan of Rihanna, personally. I do know that she has said that she's a huge Star Trek fan, so I embrace that, bringing her own fandom in and being able to work as part of something that she has an appreciation for. So I value that. I'm actually excited about the idea of bringing pop music into the Star Trek universe, because again, we're talking about JJ Trek or the Kelvin verse. And so I think it makes sense to do something a little different. Let's bring in some pop music. Let's do something to market this wonderful thing that we call Star Trek to this new generation who may not respond to orchestral music. And we've done this before, by the way, with Enterprise having a theme song that wasn't orchestral,
which also upset so many people.
A lot of people. I am not one of them. I happen to love the theme song of Enterprise.
Well, First Contact, Magic Carpet Ride.
Yes.
One of my favorite moments of the movie. But in a discussion of Rihanna's Sledgehammer, I did see some people who say that they hate Magic Carpet Ride being in the movie, that it makes no sense. But I thought it made great. And well, you've got Oobie Doobie as well.
Oobie
right?
Doobie.
They already established earlier in the film that Cochrane has this thing, you know, for music. But I thought it was great. You know, you put things in a time period. Now, of course, Beyond is set in the 23rd century, but you put things in a time period like Enterprise's theme song that's closer to us. That music is part of what creatively makes that connection.
Mm-hmm.
Between where we are now and where we're going, and shows that these people are a bit more like us. Because, face it, if we went on a road trip together, we're probably going to put some pop music or some rock music or something on to play. We might put some Star Trek soundtracks on as well, but we're not going to be all orchestral all the time, right?
No, and in fact, I share your appreciation for jazz, so we might listen to some jazz.
Yeah, nobody had a problem with Riker's love of jazz on TNG, did they?
No, absolutely not.
So, the other thing that I pointed out in our Facebook group, the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group, is that this is also not new within the Abramsverse, or the Kelvin timeline, as it's now being called. In Star Trek Into Darkness, the scene in the bar where Scotty and Keenzer are sitting in there and Kirk's calling Scotty and trying to get him to come back to the ship, there's this song playing, which was written in part by J.J. Abrams himself, called The Growl.
Mm-hmm.
What I think a lot of fans don't know is that that song was recorded in many different versions, and depending on which country you are in, you heard a different song during the movie, a different version of that song. And in Japan, Star Trek Into Darkness had a version of that song that featured Kari Pamu Pamu, who is one of the biggest pop stars in Japan. It seems like a complete disconnect. But J.J. Abrams did the song, got together with Yasutaka Nakata, who's the producer of my favorite group, Perfume, as well as Kari Pamu Pamu. His music is like EDM, it's a dance, it's electronic, mm-hmm. it fits well with The Growl. It's not what you would expect from Star Trek, but it's a great track. And if I send people the link to it and they go listen to it, they're like, oh yeah, I really like this. So it's not like J.J. Abrams hasn't done this in the past with Star Trek, and having this song in here seems perfectly fine to me. And if he gets more people interested in coming to see the film with these great posters you've seen of Rihanna,
mm-hmm.
why not? I have no problem with it personally.
I agree completely. Again, it's about attracting new fans to this thing that we love. So I think it makes perfect sense. Again, I'm personally not a Rihanna fan, but I applaud bringing her in and making her part of this project. Again, she's a fan, so why not?
Well, Mike, before we jump into the feature here, I want to thank once again our new sponsor here on the Ready Room, Eagle Moss. Now, Eagle Moss, you're probably quite familiar if you're a Star Trek fan who is diehard enough to be listening to the Ready Room and Trek FM. You know about the beautiful starship collections that Eagle Moss has released. And I love these ships, Mike. I have quite a few of them sitting right here in the studio as I record this. In fact, I'm looking directly at the beautiful Enterprise D right now. Have you been collecting these?
I do have a few of them sitting right here on my desk, and I love them. The detail is incredible. I really appreciate the work that they put into them, and they come with a wonderful full-color magazine. And if you're like me, I love to open them up and look at all the neat little details, little specifications about the ships, and just interesting little factoids. I'm all about it.
Yeah, the attention to detail is really quite amazing. When I got my first one, which was the Enterprise D, I was quite shocked, in fact, when I took it out of the package, because I've collected a number of ships in the past, both small and large, and I really had never seen a paint job and the detail in the saucer section, for example, that's like this, because it's very easy when you make a ship of this size to just say, okay, we're going to make the mold, we're going to put the basic markings on it, and people are going to know it's the Enterprise D, and that's going to be good enough. But they really went the extra mile to make sure that everything is really screen accurate.
Chris, the first one that I received was the USS Excelsior, and I was just really taken back at the detailed, and not just the basic markings, but the detailed markings on it, the texture of the saucer section. I was just blown away by the detail that they were able to put in to such a small ship. I mean, this is the kind of detail that you see in larger models.
Yeah, those larger ones that cost a few thousand dollars, right?
Exactly.
So these are officially authorized by CBS Studios. So Eagle Moss is working together with CBS to make sure that these are up to standard, screen accurate. Each model is cast in a specially formulated metallic resin and hand-painted with reference to the actual CG models used in production. And where they exist, when they can get their hands on them, they also have photos of the original studio models that they use as reference as well. So if you want to subscribe, it's really easy to do. You just go to st-starships.com/readyroom. Make sure you use that URL so they know that you heard about this on the Ready Room. st-starships.com/readyroom. And you can get the 1701D for just $4.95 with free shipping. That's your first ship. And then new models ship twice monthly and are delivered directly to your door. That's one of the cool things about this, is that you don't have to go out and search for these things. They're just going to come right to your house. So it's very, very easy. You can cancel your subscription at any time if you want, but I really believe that once you see these things, you're not going to want to cancel. In fact, you're probably going to be writing to Eagle Moss asking if you can get four ships per month instead of two. Because at this point, there are so many of the ships that it's going to take you a little while to collect them all, but it's just a highlight of the month when these things show up, because you open it. It's like you're getting a Christmas gift twice a month. And also, you mentioned the magazine earlier, Mike. Those contain original design sketches, a breakdown of the technology on board the ships, and it shows the process of how they put these together. So also a really, really nice tie-in. And they have ships, by the way, covering everything all the way from the original series through the motion picture and all the way to Star Trek Beyond. So check it out, support the Ready Room, and get great starships at the same time by going to st-starships.com/readyroom. And we really do thank Eagle Moss for their support of the show. Thank you. Some things never go out of style. Take zombies, for instance. They're wildly popular on 21st century Earth, and they can also be found in the 22nd century Expanse. But what happens when you mix the living dead with logic? That's what Archer and the crew of the Enterprise had to find out when they stumbled upon a zombified Vulcan crew in Impulse. And today we're going to talk about this third season Enterprise episode. And to help us do that, we have with us host of Continuing Mission, Mr. Dennis Costello. Hey, Dennis.
Hello. Hey, it's great to be here on the Ready Room again.
Yeah, great to have you back here on the Ready Room. You probably thought, hey, Mike's here. I guess I never left.
Yeah.
Right? All right. Also joining us, someone who knows a thing or two about zombies, as well as the twisted mind of Brandon Braga from our Next Generation show, Earl Grey, it's Mr. Philip Gilfus. Hey, Philip.
Hey, Chris. Man, I was just going through the movies here, the movie archive here on the NX-01 for the comedy night coming up. Okay, we got What About Bob? That's a good one. A lot of Monty Python. Nothing wrong with that. So I think we got some good selections coming up.
How awesome would that have been if they were watching, say, The Ministry of Silly Walks on movie night, and we got to hear Phlox talk about that?
I would like to hear T'Pol trying to analyze the logic of the parrot sketch.
She would just say, maybe we should just watch and find out what happened to the parrot.
And then Phlox is like, no, that parrot's clearly dead.
That's right. That would be perfect for Phlox. Absolutely. Okay, so today we're going to talk about Impulse, the zombie story from Enterprise. Before we do that, for those who haven't seen the episode in a while or haven't seen it before, as I always say, if you haven't seen it before, you might want to go watch it before you listen to the discussion. But if you know the story and it's been a while, here's a quick rundown. In the Expanse, the Enterprise receives a distress call from the Vulcan ship Saleya. When Archer and his crew arrive at the derelict ship, they discover that its crew have all turned into zombies. As they investigate the cause, T'Pol begins to show symptoms herself. Meanwhile, Trip and Travis attempt to mine an element called Trellium D, which is needed to protect the Enterprise from the spatial anomalies that plague the Expanse. They first try it by beaming rocks onto the ship, then they take a shuttle pod down to an asteroid and actually get the Trellium from the surface. Meanwhile, back on the Saleya, the crew are fighting for their lives as they try to unravel the mystery of the zombified Vulcans. After lots of being chased around dark corridors lit by strobe lights, the crew escapes the Vulcan ship in Shuttle Pod 1. They are joined in their quick exit by Trip and Travis, who have succeeded in procuring 60 kilograms of Trellium in Shuttle Pod 2. Unfortunately, it turns out that Trellium is what zombified the Vulcans. If the hull of the Enterprise is lined with it, T'Pol may die too. If it isn't, the entire crew may die. She and Archer have a discussion about this as she's lying in sick bay. It's perhaps the timeline's first, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one moment, and the storyline for episodes to come is set up. The episode is capped off by a nightmare sequence that drives home just how dangerous Trellium is for T'Pol, and then we're left to wonder where things are going. The episode ends very abruptly. So, those are the basics of Impulse. Let's get into the discussion with our initial thoughts. And, Dennis, why don't you start us off with first thoughts on Impulse?
All right. It's essentially a horror movie in space, right? A zombie horror movie in space. That's exactly what they're trying to pull off, and that's pretty much what they achieve. Except that, since it's an Enterprise episode on broadcast television, it's very much kind of like horror light.
And horror light. Okay.
Horror light. Actually, the structure of the episode very much reminded me of an Alien film. Mm. There was a lot of, as I was watching it, it seemed like every single point and beat that they went through was very much like the Alien movie and some of the Alien books or Alien stories that have come out since the movies.
Yeah. And as we were discussing on the other side of the room,
the other side of the room,
a video I'll probably put in Patron Zone, it also structurally reminded us a little bit of a Scooby-Doo episode.
I mean, I agree, Dennis. The part where the Mako was like, game over, Archer, game over. I could really see what was going on.
That was a bit of a surprise, right? I liked at the beginning of the episode as well, something else that we were just talking about. It almost felt like an homage to The City on the Edge of Forever at the beginning, where T'Pol is screaming, murderers! And then they jabber with the syringe. And it could have been, actually, I don't know the history of that, but knowing that Jolene was a really big Star Trek fan of the original series, who knows? Maybe she even threw that in.
She was definitely channeling her inner McCoy.
For sure. So, Philip, initial thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is one of those episodes. It's been a minute or two since I've watched a Star Trek Enterprise episode, since we're in the third season. I have to call it by the full name. But I think, when I think about it, I think Impulse is sort of in my top 10 recollection episodes. Like, I'm not saying my favorite, but, like, you know, list 10 Enterprise episodes. This is going to be in the top 10 just from, you know, the memorable, you know, Vulcan zombie episode. And I don't think it's any less enjoyable having seen it a bunch of times. But I think watching it this time, I was certainly struck by two things. One, that it does seem very short, like just the zombie Vulcan part. I'm like, this is like a 25-minute episode. And then the second thing I was struck by, and this is just a hat I've been wearing in recent months, I'm like, this is a great RPG scenario because you need them cut off from the ship, you need them stuck in a dungeon, and, you know, just things pop. They split up the party occasionally. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to remember this scenario here for any future RPG role-playing games.
How would you have felt if they screamed Alamarain along the way?
Well, I think it was interesting they did not lose any players.
That's true. And you thought they were, right? You thought that Mr. Mako was done for.
I was, and again, since it's been so long, I thought for sure, the old TOS joke. You're looking around at the characters. You're like, okay, there's Archer, T'Pol, Reed, and that guy. That guy's not coming back in that shuttle pod. But, like, Mr. Mako made it the whole time.
Yeah, he did.
I was like, especially when he was walking across the beam, like, disaster style. I was like, oh, he's a goner. Bye-bye. But, nope, he made it through. So, they trained those Makos right. So, kudos to you, Major.
Mike, what are your initial thoughts?
Well, I'm one of those Enterprise fans who appreciates a third season despite all of its problems, and we've talked extensively about those problems. This particular episode, I really enjoy. I mean, a ship full of Vulcan zombies, it doesn't get any better than that. But like Philip, I felt like it was a short episode, and truly the B-plot, I think, has more to do with the overall story arc. I appreciated the fact that at least they gave us an explanation of what happened to the people on the Von Kara.
Yeah,
there in the Expanse, I appreciated them kind of filling in that gap. But honestly, it's just fantastic Vulcan zombie freak show.
Well, let's talk about the Vulcan zombies. Vulcans gone wild in the Expanse, right? We see Vulcans without emotional suppression. And it does come up.
Chris, you keep saying Vulcans go wild, and I keep thinking about the Holosuite program I have over in Quark. So can we make sure we...
That is a popular one. You need to book early for that. I hear tickets are very expensive. A and B, Quark just raised the prices.
Yes. Well, there is that really great scene towards the end of the episode where the zombies are coming down the corridor in droves, and they're just standing there with their rifles, just picking them off. It reminds me of a zombie video game that I played at an arcade once.
Yeah. Well, I was going to mention the scene where T'Pol explains that Vulcans have emotions, they just keep them suppressed. And we've seen instances throughout Star Trek where a Vulcan has been unable to suppress their emotions and what that's like. But in those cases, usually the Vulcan crew member or the Vulcan character is in a situation where they can try to fight against that nature, they can try to regain control, but here they've just become zombies. So there really is nothing going on there anymore. And so the strength and the rage and the anger that is there underneath the surface with Vulcans is coming through. Mm-hmm. What did you think about the way that was portrayed in the story?
Well, one thing, and I don't know, this is one of those episodes where I feel like I almost feel bad for like thinking too hard about it, because it's like, it's just a Vulcan zombie episode. Don't go too deep into it. But then I, you know, this is me going too deep into it. So like, to me, it's a little...
That's what we do on Trek FM. Yeah.
To me, it's like a little... I don't know. It seems inconsistent. What is the level of cognition of these walkers, if we're not allowed to use the Z word? I don't know. Because I'm like, you know, it seems to be that they're just going to attack and claw you and that's it. But then they're the ones that just like stand there in front of the docking bay, like, okay, you're creeping me out. Then the ones that are like cooperating to like pull out the communications. I'm like, how are they communicating? Are they, you know, or is it some sort of Vulcan telepathy? Like, so like, it just seems an inconsistent of like, are they zombies or are they just, as they try to explain, like, you know, they just lost control and they're being aggressive, super aggressive. So I'm like, is there a spectrum or I don't know. That's a, it wasn't distracting, but the more I was watching, I'm like, how are they working together?
I can kind of understand that.
Well, I think it depends on which part of the story you're looking at, because there are moments in the story where it does seem like they're working together and there's some kind of communication. And then there are other moments where they're literally just walking towards you. And as you were mentioning earlier, you just pick them off, mm-hmm. shot, pick them off. And they'll almost just walk off the cliff even. They're like mindless. Like you would see like in, I remember the trailer for World War Z where they're all like pouring off the side of the building. It almost mm-hmm. felt like that on a small scale.
Right. I think that the setup is fantastic. Right off the bat, you've got a distress signal from a Vulcan ship. And right away, that gets a lot of attention because the Vulcans seem to be so far advanced over humans. What could have caused the Vulcans to need help? That instantly raises the stakes. And then they get there and they see that level of destruction of the Vulcan ship. And it's like, wow, something must have gone seriously wrong here. Just by making them the Vulcans, it really kind of raises the threat level. And then you've got this kind of mystery. There's Vulcan blood on the bulkhead. You don't know what happened. And then there's that great moment. They open that door. And the first thing that happens is this Vulcan swings a pipe and nearly hits T'Pol. It's just great. And you see I think that Jolene played it perfectly. This look of her, last thing she expected, right, is to be attacked by one of the crew members there. It's a great moment. But yes, Philip is right. You don't want to think too closely because then you start thinking about why, if they're rage, if they're filled with such rage and anger, why aren't they fighting each other? Why aren't there bodies everywhere?
Well, you know, it probably helps that I'm doing my own rewatch, and I happened to watch the episode of Voyager Gravity, which for those who don't remember, it's kind of a Tuvok love story, quote unquote. He's flashbacking to when he was young, and he had this love affair, and he had to go to a Vulcan master to calm his emotions. So I was sort of in that Vulcan emotion kind of headspace. And the more I thought about it, you know, and of course we all know this, or you know, most of us know this, that the whole, as T'Pol explains, the backstory of Vulcans, like, to me, that's an unmined thing that we've, and that's a good pun for this episode, unmined, but an unmined vein that we've never gone into of, you know, I know Enterprise it to a certain extent, but going back in time and seeing that, like, that would be something really cool. Like, are these Vulcan zombies, like, really is exaggerated, or is like that's really how they were? Then how the heck did they ever survive as civilization? I mean, I know there was the, you know, eventual Serac and all that, but you know, to me, that sort of opens a book of like, man, I would love to see that Vulcan past a little bit more, which I know it's in the novels and stuff, but that'd be something to see on screen one day.
Yeah, that they had such a violent past.
I mean, because they're basically like worse than Klingons, you know, if we're to believe the history.
Yeah, see, we're already overthinking this because. When I sit down and I think about the story as a whole, I mentioned earlier the Vonkara. If memory serves, they were en route to assist the Saleya. That's what they were doing in the Expanse.
That's right.
And they found that entire crew dead already. So why in the world didn't these 147 zombified Vulcans turn on one another? Why didn't they find them splayed open and dead? No, they're still running around the ship looking for fresh synapse to munch on.
Yeah, why didn't they find them taking showers in their clothing or something?
Exactly.
Like that?
You know, Chris, I've read about that somewhere. Where would I read about that somewhere? Oh well, I'll have to go to my Riker's googling.
Well, this episode begins what I think is a wonderful character story for T'Pol. I've heard this character arc highly criticized, by some even here on the network. But it's the beginning of her drug addiction. And I think that while you might say that it's inappropriate for a Vulcan to be put into a storyline that revolves around emotion so much, I think that from a storytelling standpoint, especially at this point, after four decades of Star Trek episodes that had been written, it was a really interesting thing to do with the character, and it charted some new territory in Star Trek, which is something that you don't always see so often. To make it work, though, you need someone who can really pull it off and who can portray that emotional turmoil and still be Vulcan, but be more vulnerable. And I feel like Jolene Blaylock does that very well throughout the third season. And she has to begin that path here as she falls under the influence of the Trillium D on the Solea. So let's talk a little bit about her and how she's portraying the setup of the story, especially in this episode.
This is really her episode. She is fantastic, yeah, in my opinion. She's fantastic in this episode. Right from the very beginning, she's just displays this kind of vulnerability and the way she kind of unravels. And there's this moment when they're in the auxiliary control room when she says, "What?" It's just so not to Paul that it just sends you kind of aback a little bit. I just think she's fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. Those flying actuator circuits, when she really starts to come undone, she's throwing actuator circuits at Reed, and you did it wrong.
She pushes him out of the way and nearly knocks him over.
She is so underappreciated as an actor, and I agree with you 100%, Dennis. This was a Jolene show. She just pulled this off.
I thought you were going to say a Jolene joint, Mike.
A Jolene.
A JJ.
A JJ.
Yeah.
Yes. She was fantastic, though. And so underappreciated. And I think this really highlights and accentuates what really makes her stand out as an actress. The way she can pull these emotions up and slowly unravel, slowly bring them to the surface, and then explode in a scene like in the control room. And then just from there, it's just a downhill spiral. She's fantastic.
It reminds me a lot about what I was told in film school, that the trick to the crying scene is that it's about the actor trying not to cry. Mm. Right. Mm. And this is all about, it's not necessarily about her exploding and having these emotions. It's about her trying to not explode, mm-hmm, you know, and try to rein those emotions in. And she's fantastic.
Well, King Henry, I mean, Philip, you're an actor, you do, mm-hmm, stage. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because having not sat down and watched all of Enterprise lately, I just remember the I think she had, because she, to me, and this is subjective in me, I could be wrong, she's always sort of played a emotions close to the surface Vulcan. And so when we had this sort of third and to an extent fourth season sort of development, you're kind of, you know, if she'd been maybe a little bit more Vulcan and flat, it would come out more. But because to me, I've always seen her sort of struggle with emotions, or whether that's the actress or the character, or, you know, I'll say, you know, tomato, tomato. But I think this is part of her greater storyline, like you mentioned, Chris. I mean, this impulse, even though, you know, you can say it's kind of a straightforward episode, you know, it's kind of, there's stuff that's come before with the you know, playing with this element before, and then what we've seen on the other Vulcan ships, and then what's going to come after, both with her drug addiction, which of course leads to whole other things with the mind meld and everything, you know, it's all sort of ties together in the
greater. It even leads to her relationship with Trip.
Mm-hmm. And the greater, Mr. Insomnia.
Exactly.
And so I think this is sort of very, a vital T'Pol episode. If you were going to do, I guess, essential Enterprise, this would be good for the T'Pol storyline.
Yeah. The Trillium D is the trigger for that. And this is a new element that they've thrown in here because they need to find a way. You know, they set up all this weird stuff happening in the expanse, right, to the ship. Well, you can't do an entire story where this weird stuff is happening all the time, because then there's no way that Archer and the crew were going to be able to save Earth. So how do you get out of that? Well, you discover Trillium D, and if you line the hole with it, then everything's okay. Which kind of makes sense, right? Because people who live in this area of space are going to have to find some way to deal with these anomalies. The twist, of course, is that there's one person, a very important person on the crew, who might die if you make use of this. And so what do you do? So that's what I call the Trillium D conundrum.
The needs of the one.
And T'Pol gets to deliver that at the end. And it sounds obvious to us watching the episode at the time that it aired, and of course watching it now. But if you put it on the timeline, this is one of the earliest instances where a human is having to understand the Vulcan perspective of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. So thinking about the Trillium elements of the story, as well as what it means for T'Pol, what it means for Archer, not just here, but moving forward. Mike, what are your thoughts on Trillium D?
Well, the arc as a whole throughout the third season, I think it's important. It's important to the character of T'Pol. I mean, you can't make her addicted to a common drug. We're telling a science fiction story. So we create Trillium D, and it's toxic to Vulcans, and she becomes addicted to it. I've often said, both on Metatrex and on Warp 5, that I think this is an important story for T'Pol. I think it's important in the Star Trek universe. I appreciate the way that it was handled here on Enterprise. I like the way that they were able to weave, you know, she says you can't allow the concern for a single crewman to affect the mission. And that's actually one of the deeper, richer moments in this episode. In fact, it's probably the only really deep, rich moment in the episode.
Right. Yeah, at the end. That's where all the meat of the episode is.
It's right there in that one scene. And, you know, Archer goes on to say, listen, I can't try to save humanity and lose what makes me human, and how rich is that? So I think it was important for the episode. I think it's important for the overall arc. I mean, long after we've forgotten about Vulcan zombies, we still have this problem with Trillium D and its toxicity to T'Pol, and how the crew is going to maneuver the expanse and how all of this is affecting her. I think it's essential.
And the part where he said that line, you know, since I'm not ingrained in season three here, I assume this is before he stole the warp core.
Yeah, he's still optimistic. Well, he's still, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, no, that's interesting, Philip, that you bring it up, because actually in Damage, when he does steal the warp core, T'Pol turns this around on him and reminds mm-hmm. him that he said this to her in this episode.
Yes, but you notice that an important difference here from Archer's perspective is that with the Trillium D, he's risking T'Pol's life. In the Damages show, it's his own honor that's at stake, and he's willing to sacrifice a piece of himself, but he's not willing to take that step and sacrifice one of his crew.
Except he's saying, I can't save humanity without holding on to what makes me human. And so then it is his own honor, but it's still, is it right? Is it wrong? Of course, we're not doing a show on Damage right now, so we shouldn't get too far into it. But
not yet, that's, anyway.
Well, Chris, the show's going to run short, so we're going to need to fill it out.
That's right. Well, after we finish, we'll record like about 90 seconds about Damage. We'll just stick it on the end of the episode.
Okay. But it'll all be a dream.
Yes, it'll all be. We'll all wake up in the same room together. That's kind of weird.
Hopefully we'll have our clothes on, though.
Yes. I don't know. To see Philip's going to lean up from the bio bed, and we're going to get that back shot there for some reason.
Can I please be a hologram?
Well, you know, one thing that also, and I know y'all know this, but one thing that also continues from this episode is it gets brought up about Archer making the decision to blow up the ship will, you know, quote unquote, haunt him later with the Vulcans. And it is, you know, this episode obviously wants to raise the stakes, might not be the right word, but at least some investment when T'Pol's like, oh, this is my old ship. Oh, okay, well, there you go. Which really doesn't come up except for, like, she recognizes the chief engineer, mm-hmm. and I guess she's supposed to know the layout of the ship. I thought they could have done a little bit more of that, maybe. Again, I'm not trying to like poke. It's not that kind of episode. But you know, if they're going to throw that out there, then
you know, when we're talking about Jolene's acting skills, I do sense a bit at the end when she learns that the ship was destroyed. She does convey a bit on her face this.
She took it hard,
right? That her old ship and crew members were gone.
Yeah, she took it very hard. But back to what you said, Philip, about Archer. I mean, yes, we still have this optimistic, you know, his values are in place and he's hopeful that the mission's going to succeed and he hasn't experienced many of the hardships that I think lead him to make a darker decision later on in season three. But as Archer is probably the most existential captain that we've seen in the Star Trek universe. I don't think his value system changes because he says, I can't try to save humanity without and give up what makes me human. So his concern is to protect T'Pol. When he steals from the Illyrians, his motivation is to protect humanity. So in his mind, he's doing what he feels is necessary in both instances to protect and safeguard the lives of those he values. And so I see some consistency there, although I don't argue that we have a much darker Jonathan Archer later on in the season.
Yeah, by the end.
I agree with that.
And then here's a question I just thought of. Was it necessary to blow up the ship?
According to Phlox, it was.
Well, I mean, why not just leave it?
Well, you know, it's part of
get pounded by asteroids and blow up eventually.
It's part of that haunted house slash that kind of alien storyline. There's always, if you think about it, there's always at the end a kind of race against the clock to get out alive. That's just one of those checkboxes that just gets ticked off. It's right down that laundry list of the haunted house or the alien kind of thing, right where with the mysterious, starts with the mysterious distress call. Then by the time you realize what danger you're in, it's too late for the easy exit. Then you've got to go through the belly of the beast to get out, right? You've got to go all the way through the ship. Somebody's hurt or needs medical attention or infected or something. And so it kind of raises the stakes. It's every single one of those boxes is checked in this episode, which is really kind of a marvelous, I think, example of that kind of writing. I really applaud it.
So, Philip, imagine that scene of the two shuttle pods racing away, but the ship's just sitting there in the background.
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't be very exciting, right?
Well, to me, to also, and again, don't think it's a bad episode, but like, it's interesting that it's like, oh God, guys, you know, our shuttle, you know, Enterprise, you got to send that other shuttle. All right, guys, we got 30 minutes. We got to send the shuttle. And then like, they're just leaving the ship and the other guys are like, hey guys, we're here. You're done. Okay. Well, I guess we'll shoot the docking clamp because we have phasers of shuttles in the 22nd century. Sure. And then boom. Okay. That was worth it. And now let's all leave. But, you know, Mike, you were talking about, and this is such a little thing. And again, because since I'm not like ingrained in season three, just, you know, I haven't watched it in a while. The beginning to me might be somewhat telling of Archer because it seemed at first that when Tripp is trying to talk about, you know, when he's playing Neelix, talking about as a morale officer, you know, like, hey, we need to do movie night. And, you know, hey, chef says the crew's not good. Archer's kind of like, hey, we're at war. Get over it. I mean, that's kind of what he's saying. But he kind of softens at the end of like, yeah, sure, let's do movie night. Why not? But it's kind of like sort of like, hey, this isn't season one or two anymore. We don't have movie nights in season three.
But it's backed by popular demand.
Is that what he's saying? They only had enough films in their library to last through 2 years of their voyage.
They went to the entire public domain those first 2 years. They got away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
At Paramount, they're like, we don't have anything else we own the rights to. So I guess movie night's over.
That was a pretty cool scene. I did like that scene. It really does drive home. One thing that they do very well in the third season is they maintain this level of kind of anxiety, this kind of constant stress level on the crew, and it builds and it builds and it builds. And this is part of that. I think it works really well for those people who do like season three. I'm one of them. This is one of those scenes that really helps that work.
While we're talking about Trillium D, it's a good opportunity to talk about the B plot, with Troop and Travis going down to the asteroid to mine Trillium, see what they can get out of it. I love the quote when at first when they're trying to just beam the asteroids onto the ship and that weird, you know, effect goes through and it messes up the transporter and then the rocks get stuck all in the walls and Trip just says, well, this will be a new one for the maintenance crew.
Yeah, that's a great moment. Now, great line.
If anyone wants to do a 15-minute weekly fan film about those maintenance guys on the NX-01, I think that would be a great show.
That would be cool. Now Philip, we're going to have to make sure that we keep our budget for that to under $50,000.
That's right.
We can pull that off.
Enterprise, like the first two seasons, they didn't even have Star Trek in the title. So I think it may have been a fan film those first 2 years.
Well, but we're going to call the show Maintenance Crew. And then people are going to get really confused. So then in the third season, we're going to call it Star Trek Maintenance Crew. And then people will understand exactly what we're doing with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was interesting because when I was watching the episode, because again, I've kind of flushed out what, I'm like, okay, man, because the asteroids effects and that's sort of pretty cool. And they're going to take the shuttle pod. I'm like, well, you know, that's pretty tricky. You know who you're going to need to pilot that shuttle pod? Travis. Oh, wait, where is he? Where's Travis? Is this one of those like Cyric Lofton? Is Travis Montgomery not in this episode? But then like halfway through, it's like there he is on the, he's transporter chief now and he's a miner. But like that was the best thing for him. Oh, okay, let's do this B plot.
And I love that you just crossed the streams with Travis Montgomery.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. Meriwether, yes. And it was also interesting to me that you had the mining part, and it made me question who was in command of the Enterprise during that part. Was Hoshi in command?
Maybe. Who was left aboard? Hoshi, Porthos, Chef.
Yeah.
Who else was there? Phlox is going to be in sickbay, though. So
we don't ever see Hoshi in command. So, I mean, like, I know because you cut to her, but she's the communications officer.
There's got
to
be somebody higher ranked than an ensign. Maybe that unnamed guy who is sitting at the helm station.
Oh, for a second, I can't remember who Enterprise Extras episodes are. I didn't know if that was him or not. But anyway, I was like, yeah, that was a very, like, whoever had that con spot, they got that extra, like, they, you know, freeze frame that.
I think they actually pan through that. The bridge in one scene. And when they come across the captain's chair, you only see the bottom of the white cuff. So I'm pretty sure it was Chef sitting in a captain's chair. Yeah, maybe. Just the white cuffs of his pants. That's all you saw. So you might have missed that part, Philip.
Okay, anything else to say about the expedition to the asteroid to mine Trillium other than it gave them a great opportunity to have a shuttle pod flying through a very cool asteroid field? And
well, the one thing I and again, having seen it, I knew it, but like when it starts with the flashback, or excuse me, the flash forward, I should say, or it goes into a flashback, however you want to say it, it kind of kills the suspense because like you know they're gonna make it. You saw the beginning of the episode, you saw the teaser, so it's like at the end when they're all crossing, well, not that I think they're gonna kill a main character, but just kind of like, well, you know, they're gonna,
well, the thing is, as I understand it, that was supposed to be the final scene of the episode originally, and then it got put at the beginning one day earlier, and so like you say, in the end it lets us know everything's okay. But it reminds me like on the new Battlestar Galactica, when they would start every episode by showing you a bunch of scenes from the episode.
My favorite, and I'm sorry, I'm going to do this. My favorite Candy episode to watch right now on Netflix is The Good Guys, which for those who don't know it, it's Bradley Whitford and Colin Hanks, Tom Hanks' son, who play cops. And every episode starts with a flash forward. It's like the episode starts with like they're two cops and they're like getting shot in a million ways. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe you did that. And every time it goes like, poof, poof, one day earlier. Like that's how every episode starts. And so I was waiting for that's how like this was going to be like, ah, and it's like, poof, poof, one day earlier.
Oh. I just want to know if Travis got his medal.
Well, he didn't get promoted, so.
He's so worried about that landing ending up in the log. I just want to know if he got his medal.
Right. Oh, man. What were you going to say, Dennis?
Oh, I was just going to remind Philip that in case he was wondering, it's a television show, which means there's going to be another episode next week. So very likely the ship's not going to blow up and everybody's going to live, or most people are going to live. So,
well, that's like, you know, like with the Dukes of Hazzard, you always knew Bo and Luke weren't going to actually get thrown in jail to stay, right? So.
Yeah, well, the Mako was not in the first scene, so in the teaser, so maybe he didn't make it. I was suspenseful the whole time.
And wasn't given away in that little teaser shot. So since everyone knows they're all going to kind of live at the end, there's no point in trying to hold it back for some extra suspense. Why not use that moment to kind of catapult the viewer into the excitement of the episode? I think it's a brilliant strategy, screenwriting, to start in the middle of the story, pulls you right in, and then you can go back and have your exposition.
And then just talking about on the actual Vulcan ship, and this is a little thing, and it's probably, again, not whatever.
Another little thing?
Yeah. But okay. Star Trek does this a lot. And for me, I'm always wondering, like, especially on Deep Space Nine, because obviously there's a lot of war going on there, where they'll have, like, rifles and they're shooting. And I always wonder, like, did that kill that dude or not? But here on Enterprise, Star Trek Enterprise, they make it very clear that the rifle is on stun, as rifles can do, as we all know. So I just thought it was like, pew, pew, pew. I'm like, oh, man, he just killed that Vulcan. Like, oh, no, it's on stun. Oh, and he's like, jink, just took my rifle on kill. Hey, now, it's not that kind of mission. Rifle back on stun. Oh, okay, there you go.
Yeah, the zombie video game scene, what you don't see is, 5 minutes later, flashes across the screen, and they all get back.
That would be funny. Yeah, you pop it in your PlayStation, and you see this, and then suddenly, 5 minutes earlier, and then you're thrown into the game.
I did reference Memory Alpha, and I guess Travis was going to get his medal in Season 5, so I'm satisfied.
Oh.
Of course he was. That comes from Manny Koto's magic bag of hindsight, Mike, which everyone who listens to the Ready Room knows about if you've been around long enough.
You know, and he wore it on sort of like the little top part there of his shoulders in this future uniform there. He would wear the medal from, so.
All right. Well, let's talk about, we've already talked about the atmosphere quite a bit because, Dennis, as you've been talking about, it is like Alien, this kind of horror flick. But Brandon Braga is very well known for really being into horror stories, horror imagery. He likes to do these types of weird things. We saw it in a subdued manner in episodes like Schisms on The Next Generation. But here it's just full on, it's a zombie story. Let's just do a zombie story. There are also some parallels here, though, to Impact Noir on Deep Space Nine, in that it also has this haunted house feel. It's an episode that I put on my list of episodes to watch on Halloween. You've got an abandoned ship, in the case of Impact Noir, a station, where you're not sure if there's anyone there, which is the case here when they first go on to the Solea. You've got the haunted house atmosphere, and you've got a crew member who is being affected by drugs. In the case of Impact Noir, it's Garak. In the case of this episode, of course, it is T'Pol. And there are those similarities in atmosphere as well as storyline. Do you have any thoughts on either of those things, atmosphere or connections in storytelling?
Well, two things. One, I believe if T'Pol spends the night in the Solea, she does win $1 million inheritance. I believe that's what's going to happen. But the second thing was, like, this is, and obviously, this is literally, not just atmospherically, a dark episode. Like, and I don't know, I was watching on Netflix. I don't know if y'all watched the Blu-ray or something, but, like, I also watched it in the afternoon. So, like, I'm sure if you watch this on night, it maybe pops a little bit, but it's actually too dark. I'm like, I don't know what's going on, right? It's like almost like X-Files, early X-Files, where you're like, half the time you're like, I don't know, there's a flashlight, I'll assume something's going on.
Well, there are a couple of things about that. So on the Blu-ray, there is a commentary with David Goodman and David Livingston, and David Livingston directed the episode. And he actually talks a bit about that, how it is so dark, and at some points, almost half of the frames get dropped because it's just black. But he talked about how it does give the viewer that feeling of, like, you kind of see what's going on, but kind of not, adds to the spookiness of the atmosphere. And then the flashing lights on the Solea, they are very random. And he talks about, from an editing standpoint, the benefit of that, because it's very easy for them to cut this episode in terms of just cutting from here to there in terms of what they shot, because the randomness of the lighting together with the darkness that you're talking about give you a lot of freedom to tell the story after you've shot it.
Chris, I'm glad you mentioned the lighting. I was fascinated at the thought that Vulcans really dig strobe lights. I mean, these aren't just...
that's true.
These aren't just Vulcan zombies. They're disco Vulcan zombies.
Exactly. They should have had some bell bottoms on.
Look, you haven't gone to a party until you've gone to the Vulcan consulate.
Exactly.
It's like they should have called this Staying Alive. I mean,
yeah. Well, I was thinking that in terms of when you go out and you try to find props, you try to stay within the budget. If they had shot this episode in the late 80s, just head down to the mall, go to Spencer's.
Yes.
You've got everything that you need right down there.
I don't know if the censors would allow half the episode then, though. It'd be a lot of blurred t-shirts.
Dennis, any thoughts on this?
Thoughts on the lighting?
The atmosphere, connections to Impact Noir, anything
well,
like that?
I'm going to confess that I'm not that familiar with Impact Noir. DS9 is one of my blind spots in the Trek canon.
Well, but, if you think Deep Space
Nine,
to
remedy that, Dennis.
If you think Deep Space Nine and then turn it about 25 degrees, that's Impact Noir.
That's Impact Noir.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. I'll have to wait and see what that means when I rewatch Deep Space Nine at some point.
But, Philip, I think if you abandoned Deep Space Nine for a number of years, it would also tilt 25 degrees. Apparently, that's just the design of the station.
Okay. Yeah. That's Cardassian construction.
Nobody's calibrated the grav plating for a while, right?
Yeah, that's how you know it's abandoned.
Exactly. That's how you know it's abandoned.
They put all the life support.
Could you see that too with like other starships? Like they encounter a Federation starship somewhere in an episode and it's always like tilted at an angle, even though there's actually no direction in space, but that's how you know that something's wrong aboard
that
ship.
Is that the vacancy sign, like a hotel? Like you'll know,
yeah.
Like
yeah.
Hanging off the nacelle. Yes.
Rooms priced to move.
Of course, the vacancy sign would be flickering because the neon gas inside is running out.
Right, it's the
because it's been abandoned.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's the interesting part with. I mean, it makes sense, but I think the contrast to Impact Noir is that you know, obviously, in Impact Noir, Garak turns into to use our language, a zombie. Basically, you know, he's out to he becomes the enemy, whereas T'Pol sort of is just. And I'm not trying to make light of it. It just is irritating. Like, she's not, I mean, she's, you know, flailing a little bit, but like, yeah, okay, boom.
Just kind of in a bad mood.
Yeah. So, I mean, it would have been, well, I don't know. I mean, again, I'm fine with the episode. I'm not trying to, but it would have been interesting if she had become more.
You don't sound like you're fine with it. Sounds like you hated it from top to bottom.
It's just a very,
I don't think so.
You don't take it for more than what it is, you know. It's like Resident Evil, you know, but not copyright. No, it's fine. It's completely different. But you know, it's sort of like if she'd become more of an active, like she, to me, I was just like stun her, fling her on your back, and then you're good.
Like they have to make a decision whether she's too far gone and then she's a threat to their survival. Because remember, this is the thing, is in season 3, the survival of Archer and the crew is extremely important because without them, Earth is gone.
Everyone is important in their post. Right. You can't afford to lose any person, like a Trip, for instance. You know,
right. And you can't really afford to lose T'Pol either. But if she were to kill the rest of the crew, then do you sacrifice her? Like that could have been a question that was raised that maybe would have added some depth to the episode.
And I guess one
they
thing,
did, Philip, they did need T'Pol to get around in the ship to try to, you know, to work the all the gear on the ship until they were just about out. And then they did stun her and throw and he does throw her over his shoulder. At that point, they no longer need her. Yeah. They don't need her directions. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They don't need her working the transceiver. They don't need her reprogramming and rebuilding stuff. As irritating as she is, she was useful in, for most of that show.
Oh, no.
But
no,
I think the difference there is that they stun her, yes, but she's still never a threat to their livelihood, right? They're just like, okay, we've got to get her back to the Enterprise. The best way to do that at this point is to just knock her out and take her back to the ship. Whereas what we're saying is, what if she were actually a threat where they couldn't control her? What if they had to make a decision to kill
yeah,
her?
Because really the only similarities between T'Pol and Garak from Impact Noir, and there are a lot of similarities between these two episodes, I agree, but the only similarity between T'Pol and Garak in Impact Noir is the fact that they're both paranoid. I mean, just completely paranoid. That really is the only similarity between the two characters.
Though I thought it was, to me, funny having, you know, remember this episode well, that in when they're in that auxiliary room, and, you know, this is basically if you're writing the DePaul storyline, like, she's sort of in the middle part of her transformation. And to me, as a viewer, having watched it, I'm like, look, she's turning right now. It's obvious. You know, she's becoming zombie DePaul. They're kind of like, let's talk her out of it, guys. All right. Hey, DePaul, I'm just going to repeat this again. We need your help. Like, dude, just, she's gone, guys. She's gone.
They'll have like an intervention for her.
Yeah, I know.
Sit her down. Right.
So, you know, Archer's gone to the like, I'm with someone who doesn't speak English, so maybe if I say it really slowly, they'll do it if I repeat it several times. And like,
just hang in there with us. When we get back to the ship, I'll have Chef whip you up all the synopses you want.
It also would have been interesting, and again, I'm glad everyone made it because it's such against the cliche that, you know, the Mako guy would die. But like, what really would they have done? The Vulcans, are they just going to be like, I got him and like, I don't know what to do with him now. Like, are they going to like claw him or just beat him to death? Or like, what's, I don't know, eat his face off?
Well, Archer does have some pretty serious scratches on his face at the end.
Which I love that Phlox totally ignored. Like, we got it. We were so concentrating on getting DePaul's clothes off, we forgot to fix Archer's.
I didn't even notice, Captain, that you had three giant scratches down your cheek.
Please sit down. Let me get my eel.
Yeah, right. It just slapped. See, now that would have been awesome if he had just like slapped the eel on Archer's face. And then Archer, that entire meaningful scene at the end of the episode, the discussion between Archer and DePaul, if he had had a giant eel stuck to your cheek the entire time. 22nd century medicine. All right. Well, let's talk about a couple more things here, actually. One is the nightmare sequence at the very end. This is interesting. It's actually been one of my favorite parts of the episode, and it has a 47 reference in it, because when DePaul goes to the turbo lift and she taps the panel, the label on the panel is 4702, which you never notice until you get to see it in high definition, but it's there. But I think that the sequence is extremely important for her character, because the episode really is about DePaul and what's happening to her, and the fact that it has repercussions, which is a big difference here at this point in time with storytelling on Enterprise. We're in 2003, I guess it was, with this season. If this had been a TNG episode, there would have been no repercussion moving forward, because that's not how storytelling was done at that point in time. But here we know that it's the beginning of a very difficult period in life for DePaul. And this little bit at the end, this dream sequence, really drives that home. And then the episode ends with her being very frightened, and you can tell she's really, really scared about what's happening to her. And then we roll credits. But this got added at the end because the episode was running short and they needed more material to fill the time. And so they went back and they shot this sequence and they tacked it on. Can you imagine this episode not having this at the end?
Takes on a whole different meaning. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was really surprised to find out that this was added because the episode was running short, frankly. And this goes right into the genius of Brandon Braga. And I know he doesn't get a lot of love sometimes from Star Trek fans because of, you know, that episode that shall not be named. But this really, and I know it came straight out of his book of weird stuff, but this is the genius of Brandon Braga to weave this simple scene in to this episode at the very end. First of all, it was geniusly executed, the whole thing. And in fact, I think they should have gotten caught in a causal loop and she just relived this thing over and over and over and over again. But the genius...
Until she sees three zombies and then she finds
exactly,
her way out of it.
Exactly. But this is his genius to be able to weave this simple scene in at the end and for it to really set the tone for the character, really for the rest of the run of the show.
Yeah, it definitely leaves you feeling that you haven't seen the last of the effects of the Trillium D. Yeah.
Because it reminded me of TNG, because, of course, like with all the Worf episodes, they always kind of end with consequences. But it reminded me of Picard when the end of Best of Both Worlds Part 2, you know, where you sort of have the straight ending, da-da-da-da, and then Picard just turns back, and you just hear those that slight music, do-do-do, and you're like, no, this is going to be with them. And I think this is what this did, much longer way, of course, but you're like, this is going to be with her. So, yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's a great point. And they do that on TNG in some moments. Here, the story continues like week after week. We're really following what's happened. That's what we didn't get on TNG with something like that. Like, we don't really come back to that on TNG until, well, family right afterwards.
Right
sure.
after, yeah.
But, you know, First Contact is probably the next time that we really, really...
Descent.
Understand the impact Descent part one this and two. Had on his life. Yeah, Descent part one and two, but... Yeah.
Iborg two.
Iborg a bit as well, but yeah, that's true. But he plays it up there, right, in Iborg. But the turmoil that it has created inside his head, I think really shines the most again when we get to First Contact.
Mm, agree.
And that's a long time gap.
And I love the way, Chris, they call back to this episode later on in season 3 when she's kind of at the height of this Trillium addiction, and she has that scene where she's in the shower with Trip and she's hallucinating this whole thing and she suddenly turns into a zombie. And I love the way they called back later on, because you really have that continuity there of the lasting effects of what started here in this episode.
Yeah, that was a creepy scene.
That was a creepy scene.
So the last thing to talk about before we go into final thoughts is just the visuals. I watched this on Blu-ray to prepare for the show, and it's really stunning. I mean, visually, what they do with the asteroid field, what they do with landing the shuttle pod on the asteroid, just approaching the Vulcan ship, seeing the ship in space surrounded by the turmoil of the asteroids. There's so much visual beauty in this episode that was made possible largely in part by technology advancing by the time they made this, you know, they couldn't do this. It's sort of like when you see that episode that shall not be named, when the Enterprise D is flying through the asteroid field in the Pegasus part of that story, you can see what it could have looked like if they had the technology to make that at the time that they did that on the Next Generation. But what do you guys think about the cinematography and the visual elements, whether it's the CGI? I mean, the Vulcan ship itself was CGI completely here as well, and how this episode looks.
Well, I've mentioned it before, but the destruction of the Vulcan ship is really startling. Really a nice effect, both as a story point and just as eye candy. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. And of course, the shuttle pods flying through the asteroid field.
Fantastic.
It's just fun. Just fun. And there's that moment where Hoshi calls him and says, your asteroid path has shifted. And they look up and they see this huge thing bearing down on them. That was a great moment. Yeah. Lots of good visuals here.
No, I agree. It was almost night and day between sort of like the dark, you know, zombies. I mean, like, in the exterior, and you're like, oh, wow, what is that? You know, so it's jarring in some ways, but in a good way. Because my favorite shot is the one you mentioned near the beginning, where you just have the tiny NXO silhouette as it's approaching the asteroid belt.
Right.
Because I don't think we've ever seen a perspective of a ship ever like that before with any of the Enterprises or the Defiant or Deep Space Nine. Because NX-01 has its very unique shape, for one thing. I mean, saucer and nacelle, but it's sort of a very unique way. It's sort of that silhouette. And also, I like that they're sort of emphasizing on this is the intent, how small it is. That it's facing the small NX-01 and this huge asteroid. And I just love that. I thought that was a great, great way to show that ship.
Yeah, that really stands out, because I don't think we've seen that. We've seen a few shots where we approach a ship from an odd perspective. We actually saw that in the last episode we talked about here on the Ready Room in Distant Origin, where we're seeing Voyager from the point of view of the Voth coming down. But still, even that, it's not quite like this, because this is clearly done to show, as you're saying, Philip, that difference in size and how tiny and insignificant the NX-01 is as it heads into this. Any other thoughts on visuals?
Well, I just thought, I mean, the asteroid field was cool. You know, it's one of those things, like, I know Star Trek Enterprise Season 3, as I'm contractually supposed to call it, but, like, if you didn't, I think you'd be slightly lost, because the asteroid's kind of hitting you. I mean, you can figure that out, but just because, like, you know, the physics, law of physics don't apply here in the, you know, expanse, you know, that was sort of like, but that's fine. But I think when you had sort of the, I don't know what the common name for the effect is of the distortion field, like, they didn't explain that, like, you're just supposed to know what that is, which is fine, but, like, that showed up occasionally. I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, this is not an episode to put on your list of here are the 10 episodes to show someone who knows nothing about Star Trek.
All of season three. Sure. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, to Paul remarks about the chaotic trajectories of the asteroids in the field. I love that shot of the NX-01 as well. I rewatched the episode today and I paused on that shot and just looked at it for a couple of minutes and just in total wonder of how incredible that shot was. I also am a big fan of the Vulcan ships, that ring drive, those ship designs. So it was really nice to get to see the intricacies of that ship design and the way the contours work together. I wish I could have seen the inside of the ship before it got turned into a Vulcan zombie shooting range, but I'll take what I can get.
Well, if you can see the Vulcan ship design is reflected in the 24th century, and that's just mainly quarters. So that's pretty much what Starfleet adopts in future ships.
I did notice the jelly bean buttons behind, I believe it was T'Pol's head in one shot. There were some TOS era style jelly bean buttons on the wall, and I stopped and I thought, yes!
Okay. Well, and there's also a TNG panel on the NX-01 when they're having trouble with the transporter. And apparently, even though you've got this giant panel that you work with, if something goes wrong, you have to run around to the other side and use a tiny panel on the back side near the bottom of the base in order to fix it. But above it, the little panel there is like a TNG LCARS type.
One thing I noticed with the transporter, and I, you know, whatever, but like the actual transporter pad, like, is that going to have to come off? Like it's just like the piece of glass or plastic or whatever it is. I felt like at any moment it was just going to like come off the top of it. And I'm like, oh, hold on. Who bolted this thing down at the beginning of the episode?
That's not bolted. They just slide those on. They're disposable. Chef uses them. He slices them up, uses them for platters to.
But a set of disposable transporter pads, Chris. What would that mean?
All right. So, well, let's go into our final thoughts here and our ratings. So, Philip, what do you have to say about this?
Oh, Shuttlepod 1, stand by. Shuttlepod 2 is coming. All right. I think for my final thoughts on this episode, I think it is what it is. You know, it's a zombie Vulcan episode. Not a bad one at all. You know, it's just a zombie Vulcan episode. And I think we pretty much covered everything. I think the only thing that was kind of weird to me at the end was, and then we are kind of discussed it, was just with like T'Pol's in sick bay and naked. I'm like, why? Okay. I mean, like, we have pajamas. We can, okay, but sure, why not? And just something
T'Pol's TV ratings, Philip. TV ratings.
Yeah. I get it. But other than that, I think this is a good episode. Just sort of a, hey, you remember that Vulcan zombie episode? Yeah, let's watch that. And then you'll be surprised because the Mako guy doesn't die. Everyone lives except for if you're a Vulcan. So it was, to me, in some ways, it wasn't very cliche, even though it's sort of the big cliche of the zombie one. And so I thought it was interesting and it kind of keeps you ingrained. You know, and if you're just looking for, I'd say, a light Enterprise episode, even though, as we've discussed, it does have repercussions both before and after, this is one just to sit down, have fun, you know, shoot some zombies on stun.
So what's your rating for this?
Oh, I would give it 5 missing medical pajamas out of 7.
Okay, so someone, 2 people are wearing pajamas apparently in sickbay.
Right. Okay. Well, you know Phlox, if nobody was there, he'd be naked the whole time, so he assumes everyone else would be too.
He would. Clipping his toenails and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. That's right. All right. Mike, how about you?
Solea, Ship of the Dead, Necropolis. It's great. This is one of those episodes, again, where I think the B plot really had more to say about the overall arc of the story. You can completely take the zombie story out of this and it stands alone on its own. And the B plot really is the driving force for the episode overall for the arc of season three. So in that regard, I think it's a little awkward, but overall, I love this episode. I love the fact that Corporal Hawkins lived, Philip. I appreciate that fact. In fact, I think in season five, they were actually going to do a City on the Edge of Forever kind of feel for this. And, you know, Corporal Hawkins must die. So, you know, whether you're a fan of Corporal Hawkins or not, you get what you want in the end. But I'm personally glad he lived. This is a fantastic episode. I think somewhere they should have had zombies running down the corridors yelling, Kolinar now, Kolinar now, you know. But overall, I'm going to give this 147 zombified Vulcans.
Very good. All right. So, Dennis, how about you?
All right. Well, I very much like this episode. They set out to do a kind of zombies in space, a horror episode, and I believe they accomplished it very well. So in my book, it's a win. We have the beginning of T'Pol's Trillium D storyline, and it's a good beginning to that storyline. So I'm going to call this a 5 out of 5 strange Trillium D lumps stuck to the side of the transporter.
All right. Very good. Well, my final thoughts on the episode are, I guess what you guys have said sums it up, basically. Just have fun, watch this haunted house, watch this zombie story, and then wait for the end for that exchange between T'Pol and Archer, which I think is very important and well-written and well-delivered. This episode for me is just the setup of the T'Pol drug addiction story. Pretty much that's it. The Trillium D does play in. It's important for them succeeding in their mission because without discovering Trillium D and without finding a way to mine Trillium D so that they can line the hole, they would not have been able to complete the mission. But I watch Star Trek, especially these days, more for the character stories than anything else. And T'Pol's character story is so strong in the third season of Enterprise and so interesting that they would go there with a Vulcan in the first place that this sets it up really well. And the episode, it's not for me the most engaging episode, but it is one that you have to watch it because if you don't watch it, you don't really understand what's happening with T'Pol moving forward. So I'm going to give this episode 8 cases of hyperventilation. All right. Well, thanks, guys, for joining us today for the discussion. And before we let you go, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs. Philip, how about you?
Sure, they can find me on the network here each and every single week on Earl Grey, the Star Trek The Next Generation based show, where I talk about how everything reminds me of a TNG episode, along with Darren Moser and Daniel Prue.
It's appropriate there, Philip.
Right,
because it is a TNG podcast.
Right. No, it's appropriate everywhere. And then they can also find me on Twitter, where my handle is NC Public Servant. That's NC for not a kazombie.
Very good. And Dennis, how about you?
Well, you can always find me on the Babel Conference, where I'm very often chiming in on whatever topic of the day happens to be discussed. And I'm the host of Trek FM's podcast about fan projects called Continuing Mission.
Great. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Well, Mike, that was a fun discussion. As we talked about a few times today, it could have been maybe like a 25-minute episode of Star Trek with zombies running around. Heading into it, I wasn't sure how much discussion we were going to get out of it, but as is so true to form on the Ready Room, we talked for well over an hour, so I guess we did pretty well.
Yeah, we did very well, and it was a fun discussion.
But as I always say, it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. We talk about so many Star Trek topics here every day of the week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some of those.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room. the DNA of Star Trek fandom, and I've said it before, fandom existed, fandom enjoyed the show, but the main charge of fandom was to get the damn thing back.
Warp 5.
The Romulans had their ship in season 4 that had the holograms that made it look like any other ship. So you could theoretically retcon Minefield into saying they were using that same technology back then.
Literary Treks.
We have a long tradition here on Literary Treks of taking things seriously and having a good time while doing that. Tonight, well, we were going to take it seriously, but then the comics wouldn't let us.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, I had a similar experience where, you know, I was talking to a guy, the new movie's coming out, obviously, and I'm like, have you seen the first one? And he's like, no, I haven't. And I'm like, okay, well, let me bring it to you so you can take a look. And he watched it, and he came back the next day, and he's like, oh, yeah, that movie was really good.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe, whether it's discussion of an episode, discussion of characters, science, philosophy. Mike's here for you on the philosophy front. Music. We just cover everything in the world of Star Trek. We release 3 or 4 episodes every single day, 7 days a week. It's really amazing how much content we're putting out and the fact that we're always touching on new things. So go check it out wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us in iTunes, where we're a featured content provider with Apple. Thank you so much to Apple for giving us that space. You can get to our artist page by going to itunes.com/trekfm. itunes.com/trekfm. That'll take you right there. You can find all of our shows there in individual feeds. Plus, we have the master feed, which contains every episode of every show that we do, and sometimes some content that's not available in the individual show feeds. It's a great way to sample the breadth of content that we have here. If you're not on iTunes, there are many other ways for you to get our podcast. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can find us in Google Play Music now. If you're an Android user and you've had trouble in the past getting the podcasts because there aren't as many options on Android for podcast consumption as there are on iOS, Google has fixed that. Just get your Google Play Music app and search for Trek.fm, search for The Ready Room, search for whatever show you want to listen to, and you're going to find us there. It's a great way to consume podcasts on Android. And The Ready Room, if you happen to be listening to this through the website, for example, and you're a Spotify user, you can also find The Ready Room there on Spotify. So check out all the shows. And if you're on iTunes and you have a free moment, we would love for you to leave us a star rating and a written review. That does help other listeners find the shows as they're searching through the iTunes store. Plus, we love to hear what you think about that. And we've gotten a few new reviews for The Ready Room in. I'm compiling them now, and I'll be reading those on an upcoming show. So thank you to everyone who has left those for us. And I hope others will do the same. So, Mike, I'm sure that many listeners have things they want to say about Impulse or the new series that's coming out or even the use of pop music in Star Trek. If they want to share their thoughts on the show today, what are the best ways to do that?
The best ways to do that, Christopher, obviously on Facebook, our listeners only discussion group certainly would be the best place to do that. Just find the show thread that you want to comment on and share your thoughts. Get involved in the discussion. Just go to the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L. Get in on the discussion. Join us. Engage us. We'd love to hear from you.
And also keep in mind that is a closed group. So when you go there, you'll need to click join, but then we'll let you right on in. We just talk about it here on the air because we want it to be for our listeners, not just, you know, someone wandering in at random on Facebook. So you will see that join button.
And Chris, they can also find the Babel Conference by going to our website, trek.fm, and clicking discussion on the menu bar.
Exactly. And in addition to Facebook, you can find us on Twitter. Our username is trekfm. You can also find our standard page on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And if you want to leave us a voicemail, we would love to hear your voice. Just go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. That's the word speak and the word pipe. .com/trekfm to leave us a voicemail. All you need is the mic on your computer, your tablet, or your phone. Record it, upload it right there on the page. It's really, really simple. Mike, let's also take a moment and thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room. Of course, there's Zachary Frueling, your co-host on Metatrex, who also sleeps on the cot on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
But in addition to Zachary, we have Renee Roberts, a dear friend of the network who has helped keep Trek FM going over the years. And I really thank Renee so much for her ongoing support of Trek FM and The Ready Room. We also have Sam Piasek, who is becoming sort of a longtime associate producer as well. Sam has been supporting The Ready Room for quite a while now. And we have two recent associate producers who I mentioned on the last show for the first time, Kay Elizabeth Janeway and Tim Robertson. Kay and Tim, thank you so much for joining the crew here on The Ready Room. And it's thanks to Zachary and Renee and Sam and Kay and Tim that we're able to get the show out to everyone each time. If you would like to become an associate producer, you can do that at patreon.com/trekfm. Just go over there and find out all the ways that you can support not just the show, but the entire network. Everyone who is podcasting on Trek FM can use your help so that we can continue to pay for the cost of file storage, hosting, bandwidth. All the distribution that goes into getting the shows out, to say nothing of the production, is very, very expensive, and it's something that we really can't, as individuals, cover ourselves exclusively anymore. And we really appreciate the support that we get from all of you guys out there listening at patreon.com/trekfm. So thank you so much for that. And in fact, Mike, you're a patron, so thank you for your support as well.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. It does take a lot of dilithium and warp plasma to keep the ship going. Well, in truth, Christopher, it takes a lot of gold press latinum, and we appreciate all of our patrons at the network for all they do to keep Trek FM sharing this wonderful content every month.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, everyone. So, Mike, if people want to share their thoughts with you directly, if they want to get in touch with other things that you're doing, where can they find you around the network? Where can they find you around the interwebs?
Well, Christopher, as you've mentioned, I am one half of the team Metatrex, along with my esteemed co, Zachary Frueling. You can always find us on the Babel Conference. Just jump into any of our show threads. You can also contact me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. On Twitter, my handle is at cmichael1701. On Instagram, I am cmichael1701.
Excellent. And if you want to find me, I'm also around in social media as well as on the network. On the network, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, which is all about Deep Space Nine. I also, from time to time, do our short news show, Hyperchannel. And then I do a lot of stuff behind the scenes that you don't see. You know, I edit Warp 5 and I publish from there to here every day as well, which has been quite an adventure this year, Mike, keeping that going every single day. But so far we're doing it. We just passed the halfway point of the project, which is incredible. Mm. Episode 184 dropped yesterday. There are 366 days this year because it's a leap year. So it's still going. So I do all that other stuff. And then you can find my writing about Star Trek if you want to read that over on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name, C, Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y, and it will come up. That's also my handle on Twitter and on Facebook and pretty much everywhere in social media. So you can go seek me out in those places if you would like. I'd also like to remind everyone about Eagle Moss and the beautiful Starships Collection, the official Star Trek Starships Collection, officially licensed by CBS Studios. It's the extensive collection of the most significant vessels from all five Star Trek TV series, plus each of the movies from the motion picture through to Star Trek Beyond. I think extensive is an understatement. They not only have the most significant vessels, they also have many of the coolest vessels that only appeared one time. So make sure you get yours. Go and support The Ready Room by signing up for the collection. New models ship twice monthly. They're delivered directly to your door, and you can start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D for only $4.95 with free shipping. Just go to st-starships.com/readyroom to get yours. Again, st-starships.com/readyroom, and we really thank Eagle Moss so much for their support of the show.
Yes, I'm looking forward to getting my Bajoran sail ship.
That's one of the really cool ones, isn't it?
Yes.
Really, really cool ones. And that's one of those ships that they really didn't have to make.
No.
Right? But I think they made it because they're like us. They're fans. And they're thinking, that's an incredibly cool ship design. We have to produce this ship.
I'm glad they did.
Me too. Okay, well, I'm going to head back down to sick bay, see if I can find those missing pajamas.
Well, Chris, I guess then it's time to stick 60 kilos of Trellium D in it because the ready room is done.